Ian McGilchrist is a psychiatrist and writer. He studied English literature at Oxford, where he became convinced that our approach to literature and art in general was too disembodied. He was elected a fellow of All Souls College, where he researched the mind-body problem through philosophy and psychology, but finding this approach too disembodied, he trained in medicine, specialising in psychiatry at the Maudsley Hospital, where he became a consultant psychiatrist and clinical director. He has researched in neuroimaging at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore and has run a community mental health team in a deprived area of London. He is a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. As well as contributions to the scientific literature in peer-reviewed journals, he has published a wide range of papers and articles on subjects in literature, philosophy and medicine, and in journals such as the Times Literary Supplement, the London Review of Books, the BMJ and The Lancet. His first book, Against Criticism, was published by Faber in 1982 and dates from before his medical training. It concerns the conflict between abstract, general, disembodied and explicit understanding on the one hand and concrete, unique, embodied, implicit understanding on the other. This concern also underlies his work on brain lateralization, which he researched for over 20 years, resulting in the book that forms the subject of today's discussion, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World, published by Yale University Press in 2010. Ian, welcome, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. It's a great privilege to have you here.
Thank you.
We won't be able to cover your vast experience and depth of knowledge in a half an hour, but we'll try. So we'll have to be very focused and go to certain aspects of it. And obviously, our listeners can go to your website and we will put links on the website so that you can, so that our listeners can access your YouTubes and also your articles and papers.
Right.
So I enjoyed your book enormously and it resonated very strongly with me. Particularly the idea of the mechanistic mind and the inability to see the whole picture, or we seem less able to focus on the whole picture and more able to focus on the detail. And that applies to so many different walks of life. Can we begin by talking about the divided brain and its significance?
Yes, indeed. Of course, the topic of hemisphere difference has become a toxic one in mainstream neuroscience because of a pop psychology culture which started in the 60s and 70s and then went into middle management courses and is considered tacky, and indeed most of the things that are bandied are about the differences between hemispheres are plain wrong. However, it's illogical and unscientific to suppose there's not a difference. The two halves of the brain are asymmetrical in absolutely every measurable respect, both physical and physiological. So, anatomical and physiological. So, I was intrigued by what this difference might be, and to cut a long story short, by reviewing an enormous body of work in the animal literature and then in human neuroscience, what seems to be the principal reason for this rather extraordinary fact that the brain, which exists to compute and make connections, is divided down the middle. The reason for this seems to be to do with a very important survival need. And that is for an animal to be able to manipulate the world, to get food, to pick up, say, a seed against the background of grit, to pick up a twig precisely and place it in a nest, or to catch its prey. For this, it needs a very narrowly focused and very sharply focused kind of attention of a very, very small arc, probably about 3 degrees, and it's already committed attention to its object. However, if it only was able to pay that attention, that kind of attention, it wouldn't survive. Because at the very same time, it needs to pay the precise opposite kind of attention, which is a broad, open, sustained vigilance for whatever else might be. Predators, obviously, but it could be conspecifics. So what it turns out is that animals and birds, and indeed human beings, use these two kinds of attention for different aspects of their survival. And To begin with, when I discovered this, I wasn't aware of quite how significant it was. I just thought of attention as yet another sort of cognitive function, if you like. But my philosophical background made me think, but attention is incredibly important. It's an aspect of consciousness, and it helps create the world that we find. So if there are two types of awareness or two types of attention going on at the same time, they must be creating different kinds of a world, because the kind of attention we pay governs what we find. And, of course, the world that we find governs the kind of attention we in future pay, and so on. So there is a kind of vicious or virtuous circle in the world. And, indeed, what I found was that if you stop thinking about what the two hemispheres do that's different, like, on the one hand, it was said that the left hemisphere sort of does language and reason, and the right hemisphere does sort of pictures and creativity and some nebulous, fluffy way. This is completely wrong. We know that both hemispheres are involved in absolutely everything, in music, in language, in reason, in emotion, and so forth. But they are reliably different in the way in which they do it. So the kind of attention that they pay produces a different aspect of each of those things.
So we'd see a different world through each of those lenses.
We do. And you might say, but that's bizarre because I'm not aware of this. Of course you're not aware of it because, again, for survival reasons, you must not be aware of it. If you were aware that you were being offered two versions of the world that don't entirely mesh, you wouldn't be able to act. So for all sorts of good reasons, at a level that's very low below consciousness and is probably operating from the midbrain, so the top of the brain stem, we alternate between these different modes of attention, and we're not aware of that. Now, the significance of that is that when you start to articulate about the world, when you have a culture, your intuitions are that there are, in fact, two kinds of a world, because you do, in fact, experience the world in different ways. But if you want to appear logically consistent in your theory about the world, you have to plump for one or the other. And, in effect, the left hemisphere's take on the world is an easier one to articulate without having to tackle certain sort of paradoxes. So it tends to be the one that comes to dominate.
Is that because it's more simplistic and less complex?
It is. I don't want to give the impression that there's something faulty with the left hemisphere's take. It's very important, as I say, for survival, but it's not, if you like, true to reality. It's a version of reality that helps us engage with it. But the right hemisphere is the one that sees the bigger picture, literally, and has a broader attention, and is able to see how the parts relate. And, you know, there's fascinating literature which I explore in the Martin's Hemisphere that shows that when people have damage to the right hemisphere, the world becomes a heap of fragments, bits that don't clearly relate, unless you put them together in some rationalistic way.
So I was fascinated by the pictures of the flower and the tree as a result of a stroke in the right hemisphere.
Yes, I think you're referring there to some very interesting experiments which were done with isolating one hemisphere of the brain at a time and asking it to carry out various tasks. And what's interesting is that its representations of real-life things like flowers, trees, and people become entirely symbolic and geometric, whereas the ones done by the right hemisphere have the aspect of a living, flowing organism. And that actually is one of the basic differences between the hemispheres. One sees pieces that are static, separate, can be put together mechanically to create something, are essentially fragments to which it's not clear how we relate, but we relate in some very objective way. In the right hemisphere, everything is connected, so there is nothing that is purely isolated. That is a useful fiction that things are separate and isolated. It's a useful fiction that they're static, because in fact they're always changing, they're always flowing. And it's a useful fiction that we don't have a relationship with them, but in fact our attention to them changes what they are. So those two worlds have quite different philosophical properties. Mm-hmm. And if we decide to rely on a version that comes purely from the left hemisphere, we end up with a rather limited view of what the world is like. And I believe that we have done this rather excessively in recent history, in the last 100 years, and this has led to distortions in reality.
Why has that happened?
I think there are a number of reasons. I mean, the first and most important one, I think, is exactly this point, that as a culture has to create a myth, if you like, a philosophical idea of what a human being is, what the world is like. And, you know, we don't think of them as myths, but they are. You know, when Dawkins says that everything is mechanical, that is a kind of a myth. It's comparing living things with machines. And in doing so, it brings out certain aspects of them very well. It, however, makes other aspects of them disappear. And so when you're looking at things, it depends which model. Now, if you're going to have a model that you can articulate easily and is self-consistent, then the left hemisphere's model is a much easier one to use than the right hemisphere's. And trying to bring them both together, because in fact they both contribute aspects to reality, leads you to have to articulate things that seem on the face of it a bit contrary or paradoxical. In fact, a lot of us understand intuitively from experience that there are aspects of reality that are apparently paradoxical.
Yes.
And indeed, we run into this in the modern world all the time. We go into Iraq to create peace and stability and don't quite succeed in doing that. We have wonderful algorithms that will predict movements in the stock market, so there will never again be a catastrophic crash, after which there is immediately a catastrophic crash. And, you know, there are many, many examples. I'm writing a book at the moment, which for Penguin called Porcupine is a Monkey, which is actually about these problems and why they happen, how we misconceive what we're doing in this world, misconceive what human beings are, misconceive what society is, misconceive what kind of thing the world at large is and how we relate to it.
So in a way, because the left brain version of reality is, or the left hemisphere version of reality, is like a map. It allows us to grasp and
that's a brilliant image,
and manipulate
information
and to give us the illusion of certainty.
Exactly. When you are fighting your campaign, you don't need to have all the detail about reality. You want something schematic and simplified, and that is much more useful than having too much information. But of course, it mustn't be mistaken for the reality. And it gives an impression of things that are, as I say, fixed, static, and certain, when everything is uncertain, fluid, and connected with everything else. So, yes, it creates an image of the world which is useful, but the problem comes when you start to think the world really behaves like this model, and it doesn't.
Mm. So that gives rise to processes and procedures and approximations to reality, and I was laughed in your book when I read about the operation was a success, but the patient died. And your corollary to that was, well, at least there was an operation rather than ticking the box.
Yes, nowadays all you need to do is tick the box, and apparently there was an operation.
So at least there was something that happened.
And
I think that this need to be certain and to have control over the world that we live in is, of course, very important, but you call it an illusion.
I do indeed. I think it's one of the most dangerous illusions we have, that anything is certain. In reality, things are not. And a lot of the terrible things that flow from this cast of mind in which certainty is required and believed to exist are all around us. For example, it leads to religious fanaticism, and it leads to atheistic fanaticism, people who simply can't tolerate any kind of suggestion that they haven't understood the totality of things that exist.
So we reassure ourselves that we know that the world behaves predictably because, in a way, this is a closed-off world.
It's a closed-off, that's right, a sort of hermeneutic, sealed sort of world that works very well on its own. I don't know whether we've got time to explain a wonderful piece of research, but let me explain it. This is where a group of subjects were asked to say whether a syllogism was true or not. And a syllogism is a series of expressions that lead to a conclusion. So the usual example that's given is, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, Socrates is mortal. There was, however, a twist in these syllogisms. The second premise was false. So all monkeys climb trees. The porcupine is a monkey, clearly not the case. The porcupine climbs trees. Now, the subjects were asked to say, is this conclusion true? In three conditions, one with the brain intact, one with the left hemisphere only, and one with the right hemisphere only. And to cut a long story short, with the very reliably, all the subjects across a range of examples, when they were using their whole brain or their right hemisphere, they said, no, of course it's not true, because it doesn't correspond to reality. Mm-hmm. But using the left hemisphere, the same individuals on a different day said, of course it's true, And when asked why, they said, well, because that's what it says on this sheet of paper. So in other words, the internal consistency of the system was prized above testing it against experience and reality. And I believe we've moved into a world where our theory about what, our scheme of how life is supposed to operate, trumps our experience.
Wow.
We're told to disattend to our experience and believe the protocol, the algorithm, the schema that is handed down to us, often by management, which probably leads to questions about leadership.
Yes, because it makes me think about, the implications for medical practice as well is you've got a real-life patient in front of you who doesn't behave in predictable ways.
Correct.
And neither does the condition, because it interacts with every other part of the body. And yet we have a scientific method which may not help us to see the whole picture, either in management terms or in medical practice.
Yes, once again, the scientific approach is enormously rich and valuable, but it can't be everything. I mean, that is the simple point.
Yes.
It's not that there's anything wrong with it per se. It's that it simply can't be the only way we think. And so it narrows down the focus, often away from things that are really the cause of the patient's suffering. I remember when I was a houseman, you know, people would come in on surgical take with abdominal pain and on medical take with chest pain. And most of these people were subjected to a battery of procedures and tests and then sent home without a diagnosis. But nobody thought of sitting down at the bedside of these people and asking about what's going on in their lives, which was probably the cause of their abdominal pain and their chest pain. So if you start thinking too mechanistically, we miss the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And this is made much worse by having procedures and algorithms that have to be followed. They have a bogus air of clarity and correctness about them. But in fact, because no person ever fits into any of the boxes that we have, not really, because they're all unique and they've all got different ranges of problems that interconnect, any one standard procedure is actually a less precise fit than something that is uniquely your response to this particular patient.
So we've made huge advances in medicine using science and research and the scientific method. But maybe perhaps we've lost something of the uncertainty and the humanity and the real-lifeness, the embodied life.
Yes, I mean, embodied skills, which are the fruit of experience and give rise to something that it sounds almost pompous to mention, but a degree of wisdom about how to practice. Those things are intuitive, implicit, and gather together a lot of information that gets excluded when you start to become explicit. There are many things that get worse by being made explicit, including lovemaking, religious worship, jokes, mm-hmm. metaphors, poetry, mm-hmm. all these valuable things, once they're made explicit, their value disappears. And a lot of the clinical business of dealing with patients at the level of nursing or in through doctors is something that is an art as much as it is a science. And whenever there's a disaster on the ward, there is an inquiry, the result of which is a thick manual with all sorts of procedures. And now what has happened is that nurses spend, some of them calculate 50-60% of their time, not on the process of nursing patients, but on the meta process of planning it, recording it, entering things on computers and so on. And sometimes you walk on a ward and think, you know, where are the nurses? You go to the office and there's a typing pool where the nurses are busy looking at screens. If this is not a way to make sure that problems will arise on the ward in future, I don't know what is. This is crazy. It's demoralizing to the staff who are not allowed to use the products of their training and experience intuitively. And it's demoralizing to the patients who find that the nurses are more interested in ticking boxes than in talking to them. And, you know, this is just the way for medicine and nursing to become trivialized.
And in a way, this is partly a cultural phenomenon in that it's in every place. It's not just in medicine. It's in every organization where they seem to get further away from the actual job and more abstracted into processes that account for what they have done.
Absolutely.
And defend themselves against attack.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so in this world, which I believe is dominated by a kind of thinking generated from the left hemisphere and unalloyed by anything from the right hemisphere, what happens is that the abstract and general becomes more important than the embodied and the actual, if you like. And so as people get to be better teachers, they stop teaching and become managers. Mm-hmm. As they become better nurses, they stop nursing and become mm-hmm. managers and mm-hmm. so forth. So you're quite right, it's across the board. And this kind of thinking turns our universities into factories for utilities, when in mm-hmm. fact that completely misunderstands mm-hmm. what an education is. It makes the police act according to a set of rules, where in fact in the past they were more able to respond flexibly to things. In every walk of life you can find this.
So how can we get back to some sense of balance between these two really important functions, because neither one is better or worse than the other?
No, I'd slightly qualify that. I think that although they are both necessary, one is more important than the other.
Okay.
So as in most things, it's not symmetrical. The title of the book that I wrote, The Master and His Emissary, embodies this idea. The concept is that the master of a small community that flourishes because of his wise management realizes as it grows that he can't manage everything, so he delegates to his brightest and best to be his emissary and go do certain work on his behalf. But the idea of the emissary is he goes and does that work and then reports back to the master. But because the emissary doesn't know what the master knows, he thinks he knows everything. In other words, he doesn't know what it is he doesn't know. Mm-hmm. And that is a fatal mistake, because he then thinks he's the master and adopts the cloak of the master, and so things fall apart. So in a way, the right hemisphere's take on things is where our experience of life originates. Our first apprehension, literally, I mean, this is work by Elkin and Goldberg in America, begins in the right hemisphere. It then gets sort of, as it were, at another level processed by the left hemisphere, unpacked and made explicit and so on. And then that needs to be forgotten and reintegrated, if you like, into mm-hmm. the whole. Mm-hmm. This is similar in language. The idea that we want to express begins as a global synthetic idea in the right hemisphere. It then goes to the left hemisphere to be made serial and analytic in speech. But then the meaning of the entire utterance is understood by the right hemisphere. The left hemisphere sort of looks up the words in the dictionary, if you like, and strings them together according to the rules of syntax, but doesn't understand what one actually means by the utterance. So always it's the right to the left and then back to the right. The right is the master, not the emissary. One image I often use, because it makes it very clear, is if you play a musical instrument, you're attracted to a piece of music. That's, as it were, one's beginning in understanding. One then starts to play it and realizes there are passages that need work. You need to do the fingering and so on. And you also begin to see, this is where we shift to the dominant and so on. All this is analytic and breaks the thing down into pieces. It's necessary, mm-hmm. but it isn't the end of the story. Mm-hmm. Because when you go on stage to play, you have to forget all that. Otherwise, performance really won't work. So there's always this progress. So we need them both. But at the moment, the emissary, the left hemisphere, is the dominant one when it needs to be the servant.
Yes. I was really interested in, when I was reading your book, about the capacity of the left brain to generalize and abstract from
yes.
lived experience.
Yes.
And then the need to, which is what you're saying, to return back to lived experience.
Yes.
And also that the left brain is represented with experience, and that concept intrigued me as well.
Yes.
That the original presentation is perceived through the right brain, the
yes.
right hemisphere.
Yes.
And then it's represented and generalized in the left hemisphere.
Yes, probably that is correct. And it comes back to the idea that the left hemisphere has a map, whereas the right hemisphere experiences the terrain. And as I mentioned Goldberg's work, but I mean he and colleagues have repeatedly shown that every kind of experience, when it's at the sort of preconceptual stage, when we're actually just in its presence without mm-hmm. sort of having thoughts mm-hmm. about it,
mm-hmm.
seems to be in the right hemisphere. And then once it becomes a concept mm-hmm. and as it were goes into a box, a pigeonhole, then it moves to the left hemisphere to be processed, as it were.
But that's not the end.
But that's not the end of the story. That needs to be reintegrated, yeah.
And what about emotion and reason? Because in a way what you're saying is that we create the world, well, there is objects in the world and there is experience. But in some way or other we shape and create the world that we live in.
Inevitably we do, because we can only know the world that we know. By definition, we can't know about anything else. So everything we know about the world comes through our experience in the first place. And that experience is modified by the way we choose to look at the world. When we choose to look at something in one way, we see one thing. When we look in another way, we see another thing. That's been demonstrated beautifully so many times, neuropsychologically. So clearly the world we are in is something that we don't make up. I'm not suggesting that. There's something there, but what it is ends up for us depends on how we use it, how we respond to it, how we attend to it. And the word attend actually means to reach out a hand.
Yes.
So it's how we go to meet it. And if we stand there, arms folded, detached from it, we get one impression of the world. Mm-hmm. If we go to meet it, mm-hmm. we get another. In terms of reason and emotion, I want to stress that the idea that the left hemisphere is unemotional is completely wrong. For example, one of the emotions that most strongly lateralizes is anger, and it lateralizes to the left. And reason, again, is not the prerogative of the left hemisphere. A certain kind of rationalizing procedure is better carried out by the left hemisphere, but reason, i.e. balancing that with experience and intuition, is better done by the right hemisphere. And some mathematical thinking, it appears, depends on right hemisphere processes to see shapes and to see how things fit together.
And to leap into the future, to the unknown. If you think about Einstein saying that a lot of his intuitions came from looking into the fire and watching the flames.
Well, yeah, and that story is about Kekulé, actually, about the aromatic ring. But there are a number of, you're quite right, Einstein and Poincaré, for example, describe reaching conclusions at a single moment like that, and then spending weeks trying to articulate why that is right. And there's a lot of understanding that is of this nature. We just have articulated to ourselves that the way we understand things is by putting them together in a series, but actually we don't. That comes later, and it's just an adjustment that enables us to manipulate it better.
So we go back to, we have an experience or an intuition about something, and then we try and figure it out and take it apart and see, why should it be like that?
Yes.
Or is it really like that?
Yes, of course, whether that process can answer the question whether it is really like that is a philosophical debate we can't go into now.
Right. But it's about truth.
Yeah, about what reality is. But on the other hand, we do need both kinds of thinking. We need to be testing intuitions against our reason, and we need to be testing our reasoning against intuition. I mean, intuitions can lead you astray, sure, but so can rationalizing. I mean, that is, a very easily demonstrable fact. So we need to use both. And as Kant famously said, intuitions without reason are blind, but reason without intuition is empty. And, you know, you need both of these things.
People would be shocked, I think, by you saying that rationality on its own can lead us astray.
Well, it's been very nicely demonstrated by a whole swathe of recent neuropsychological culture, where reasoning about something makes one make worse judgments than one had made initially before one started reasoning about them, for example. And reasoning will only unpack and make a picture consistent with its premises. So it has no way of getting outside the system. So you offer it premises which can't be reasoned to. They are the premises you assume. And then you say, go on, reason, work out, unpack what this will lead to. The trouble is that often our premises are wrong. Our premise might be the body is a machine. That is a reasonable starting point. We then use reason to unpack that. But to the degree that that is not a correct premise, it will unpack stuff and lead us in a path where we shouldn't be going, because it's leaving a lot out.
Yes.
So I always say about reason that we have to intuit the value of reason. We can't reason to the value of reason, and we can't reason to its starting points, and we can't reason about the value of its conclusions. We need other parts of our minds, other parts of our brains, other parts of experience to use it. So reason is a tool. It can't tell us anything more than, you know, a spanner can't explain a car, but it can help you put one together.
Right. Good. Thank you. Ian, I want to conclude by thinking about the world in which clinical leaders live. Mm. They live in a managerial world which is dominated by control systems and regulation and things that they don't really understand and are quite abstract and far away from clinical practice on the ward with the patients.
Yes.
What do you think they can do to live in this world and survive in it?
Well, I think the first thing to do is not to lose confidence in their judgment that there's something amiss here. The left hemisphere is a natural bureaucrat, and I'm afraid, if you like, I mean, I'm speaking figuratively, of course, but this kind of thinking whereby everything is controlled leads to terrific mediocrity. It rules out excellence, and it doesn't actually stop disasters from happening, as I've suggested. So it is a pernicious element, which is like a cancer, and essentially takes up the sort of useful life of the organism of the medical sphere by substituting it with a lot of meta-regulation and paperwork. So doctors should never feel obliged to be the tools of this kind of thinking. In fact, they have an obligation to resist it. And I read a marvellous book recently called The Blunders of Our Governments. It's effectively a very even-handed review of the last 40 years of government, both Tory and Labour. In which the essential point is catastrophes occurred because everybody thought they'd better go along with what the sort of the managers were saying. And nobody had the courage to say, but this is actually the wrong path. And an absolutely essential element in any system is those who are saying, but there are problems with this. And that's not often welcomed by management, but it is essential that somebody does this. You have to be brave and you have to say it, because nothing less than the survival of a proper professional medical service depends on being able to articulate the reasons why this may be highly problematic. And in essence, I think I would like to see doctors go back to the notion of themselves as human beings dealing with other human beings, not as clever, abstract machines for processing things that have gone wrong in other machines. And partly this has to do with medical education. In America, you can't do medicine as a first degree. You have to have done something else. Well, that might be impractical in Britain for various reasons. I don't know. But we now live in a world in which it's quite possible, and it probably wasn't 50 years ago, to go into medicine without any background at all in the humanities, not having any philosophical training or any understanding of literature and the arts. And it may seem to you entirely obvious that the people are machines of a kind, and you know, unreflectingly one accepts it as the natural model. But anybody who's done the slightest bit of philosophical training will know that it's highly problematic and that one needs to question it. And so I'd like, the way in which doctors are trained is very much, don't ask questions, imbibe this information, and just get on with doing what you're told to do. But actually, to be good doctors, we have to be constantly questioning what we're doing. And I think, because I've spoken this year, I spoke to the Royal College of Physicians about the problems of the machine model, and the reception I received from physicians was, frankly, rapturous. So people are longing to be confirmed in their view that there's something wrong with this. But they need to have the courage of their convictions and not fall into just doing more of it.
So we need to go back to getting some balance of the right hemisphere functioning through literature, through philosophy, through the humanities.
Well, I mean, clearly most doctors are far too busy to have time to be sort of fitting all this into everything else they're doing, which is a shame. But I think at some stage in their education, that is an important element, and I accept that they have more and more to learn. But sometimes it's important to start off from the right place, and getting the base right is the key thing. After that, they can always learn technical stuff about virology and so on, but at least they will have a context in which to set that information. It doesn't end up just being freestanding information that you know, has no meaning.
Yes.
And I think, you know, to have that basic context of what we're doing when we're doing medicine, what a human being is, what a human life is, what a disease is, to think reflectively about this is very important in producing doctors of the future.
And I was struck by a young medical student telling me yesterday that she couldn't believe the change, the leap that she had to make from the lecture theatre to being in a consultation with a patient.
Yeah.
And how that didn't seem to be mediated. It seemed to her to be like jumping off a cliff.
Yes, yes.
Suddenly I'm expected to know things. I'm expected to diagnose.
Yes.
And yet I have a really complicated, uncertain world that I'm living in. So she very much spoke to me about the fear involved in having this mechanistic model, which didn't really fit with the reality of being in front of a patient and dealing with your own uncertainty.
I think, you know, dealing with one's own uncertainty without trying to banish it by a false certainty is really accepting that things are uncertain.
Yes.
Patients need to accept that, you know, medicine can't answer all their problems and that they are going to die one day. Their fears about that can lead to over-medicalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors' fears of being sued can lead to over-treatment of patients in ways that are unethical and unhelpful.
Mm-hmm.
And so accepting one's vulnerability, accepting one's uncertainty, but nonetheless moving forward in the knowledge that through experience one will get better at this. That medical student is at the first stage. It's like riding a bicycle. You fall off quite a few times mm-hmm. before you get the knack.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no shortcut to that. Nobody just gets on the bike and rides first time.
Okay, I think unfortunately we have to end it there because we've run out of time. But thank you very much. It's been really interesting.
It's been a pleasure to me.
And it's frustrating to me that we can't go on for longer. But there's a lot of material on your website and your book is well worth reading. And there are YouTube videos where you can see summaries. The other thing to say is that we have a webinar with you for which we thank you. And that will be on the 28th of January between 6:30 and 7:30 in the evening. And there people can ask live questions and we can go back to some of the ideas that you have highlighted today and talk to people who are out there thinking things and having questions. So once again, thank you.
I look forward to the webinar very much and thank you for having me here today.
Pleasure.